Danone Nutritia Campus is an open science education platform for healthcare professionals overseen by a not-for-profit foundation. The foundation is led by an independent board of medical professionals and academics with one clear goal: to advance the field of nutrition and health from infancy to old age through growing knowledge, training and education of healthcare professionals around the world in collaboration with medical and scientific communities.
In May 2020, a webinar was hosted by Nutritia around COVID-19 in pregnancy, breastfeeding and infancy. A range of questions were asked by the healthcare professional audience, and since then, a lot of new scientific insights appeared in the news. My name is Zoe Ellis. I'm a registered nutritionist and have been working for Nutritia for 5 years. And I'm specialised in the nutrition in the first 1,000 days. Joining me today, remotely of course, is Dr. Sarah Jarvis, general practitioner working in Shepherd's Bush, London. She also works in the mass media to promote health, is a health and medical reporter for The One Show, a regular guest on The Jeremy Vine Show, and clinical director for health website patient.info. In this podcast, the third and last of a series of three, we'll be answering the top questions that were asked following the webinar, and Dr. Jarvis will go into all the recent science that was released since then. Dr. Jarvis, nice to have you back for the last podcast in this series on COVID-19 in the first 1,000 days.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
In May 2020, the numbers of infected infants were very low, and of these, very little needed hospital admissions. Has there been an update since then?
There has been a great deal of change in the last year, but certainly as far as children are concerned, overall, the news has been very good indeed. Sadly, in the UK, we've had a very high death toll from COVID-19, about 150,000 people, but of those, only about 10 out of 150,000 have been under the age of 17. And basically, the death toll has been virtually zero out of those 150,000 for any child under the age of 5. Babies are at exceptionally low risk of any serious complications from COVID-19. Now, interestingly, since May last year, we have found more about the likelihood of children having COVID without having symptoms. So actually the numbers of children affected by COVID are probably higher than we thought. But, and here is a very big but, where flu is concerned, for instance, children are what's known as super spreaders. They can get seriously ill with flu, but they are less likely to than, say, vulnerable older people or people with lung problems. But they are extremely effective at harbouring it and at passing it on. What we have seen with children is that in younger children in particular, they appear to be less likely not just to have symptoms, but actually to have the infection or to spread the infection. And all of that is very reassuring. However, there has been a condition of significant concern, so-called MCIS, multisystem inflammatory disease, and it often has sort of overlapping features of toxic shock syndrome and atypical Kawasaki disease, including the skin rash. So what we have seen is that when children do get it, and they don't get it very often, the best data that I've been able to find comes from Sweden, where about 1 in 130,000 children aged 1 to 16 years who were admitted to ICU had MCIS, multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. And during that period, schools were open throughout. So I think that really does give you an idea of quite how rare it is. There were 15 admissions. 11 of them were over the age of 11, so very few among young children, and there were no deaths among those. That's not to say there haven't been any deaths worldwide, but it is very, very low. But a few points have become really clear. The first is that it is much more likely in children of African ancestry, and we just don't know why. The second is that the features include a rash, and that rash classically affects the lower limbs, the inner thighs, the upper extremities, and the chest. that the rash usually will start as annular plaques about maybe half a centimetre across, about the size of a fivepence piece in the United Kingdom, and that a lot of children would also develop so-called purpura, which are those tiny red dots underneath the skin from very small bleeds underneath the skin, and those were often inside the plaques. But in terms of other symptoms, gastrointestinal symptoms seem to be the key. So diarrhea, vomiting, abdominal pain. And once they're admitted to hospital or severe enough to be admitted to hospital, then hemodynamic instability, so low blood pressure and shock and so on, do appear to be features, and myocarditis, in other words, inflammation of the heart muscle, is also relatively common. So all of those things are features of this condition. They tend to be treated in a similar but not quite the same way as Kawasaki disease. The classic treatment is with intravenous immunoglobulin. About half of children with MCIS also need corticosteroids. But overall, the outcome, although very worrying for parents in the short term, the outcome has been good. What that really means is that overall, although children do sometimes get severely ill, it doesn't tend to be with acute complications of COVID. MCIS can happen up to a month or two afterwards. And if they do get it, it's highly unlikely that it will happen. And if it does happen, although serious, it tends to respond very well to treatment. Now, interestingly, in the UK, as a result of this and as a result of the data that has emerged, in the UK, we had about 2.3 million out of our population of 68 million people who were advised to shield. They were the people who were thought to be the most vulnerable. We've subsequently added another 1.7 million to that, so about 4 million in all. In the first instance, we included quite a lot of children. And they were children, for instance, with very severe asthma, people whose immune systems were very compromised, children with cancer, and so on. Actually, the vast majority of those have now been removed from the shielding system because although children are more likely to become severely unwell if they have one of those conditions, because their risk is so tiny, even with an increased risk, they were considered not to be at very high risk.
Is there any news of vitamin D in relation to COVID-19, especially for infants?
So we routinely recommend that all children should have access to vitamin D. Now, the Department of Health recommends that from the age of 6 months to 5 years, children should be getting a vitamin A, C and D supplement in the UK. From birth to 1 year, they recommend that they should be having 8.5 to 10 micrograms of vitamin D. And from 1 to 4 years, 10 micrograms of vitamin D a day. That's 400 international units, actually the same as an adult. Breastfed babies will need to take a vitamin D supplement, even if their mother is taking a vitamin D supplement, as she should. Babies who are taking over 500 mils a day of formula do not need to take vitamin D. But even if the mother is supplementing, if she's breastfeeding, the baby should have a supplement. Very, very easy to take. Interestingly, we do know that children who have COVID have significantly lower vitamin D levels than controls. But again, we're not absolutely certain how much of that relates to the vitamin D per se causing more severe COVID, or whether it's so-called confounding factors, particularly among children. And again, because children don't tend to be badly affected and they tend to get such mild disease, then we think it's highly unlikely to be of significance. However, what's interesting is that, for instance, fever is significantly higher in COVID patients who have deficiency or insufficiency. This includes adults as well as children, compared to if their levels are sufficient. And there is a direct correlation between the height of the fever, the severity of the fever, and the vitamin D level.
So what would be your advice towards our listening healthcare professionals that are seeing infants regarding preventative measures according to the latest insights?
I would say you can very much reassure your parents. There are many conditions where children are more likely to be affected, such as, for instance, meningitis, meningococcal meningitis, and whooping cough, of course, where we know the vast majority of people who are severely affected are infants under the age of 1 year, and particularly under the age of 6 months. One of the very few reassurances, one of the very few less ghastly things about this pandemic is that so few children have been severely affected. I would actively encourage mothers to breastfeed, knowing that even if they are infected with COVID, their child is highly unlikely to become unwell. But I would advise them to be aware of those signs of MCIS. That's rashes, particularly in the lower limbs, the inner thighs, the upper extremities and the chest, and these so-called annular plaques with these little dots, the purpura on them, and particularly in a child who is generally very unwell in themselves and who has gastroenteritis type symptoms with diarrhea, vomiting or tummy pain.
Now, countries are already starting with vaccinations of adults. This is mostly happening in the developed countries. And we're already facing the release of different new ones as well. Is there also any news on vaccinating children or even infants?
Not as yet. And of course, what we know is that unlike with other conditions where children are the most likely to be affected or among the most vulnerable groups, children are very rarely severely affected. We have seen cases, particularly in older children, of so-called long COVID. We're not sure as yet whether or how much vaccination protects against those. We know that the Pfizer vaccine has been authorized for age 16 and up because that's what the studies have been done on. We know that Moderna has been authorized for ages 18 and up, as has AstraZeneca. But both Moderna and Pfizer have begun clinical trials in younger children. Now, the main reason for that is likely to be when or whether we start considering looking at so-called community immunity. Herd immunity. In other words, getting enough people in the population who are immune to SARS-CoV-2 infection, to COVID-19, that we can prevent it from circulating entirely and indeed, one would hope, eradicate it. That is the happy position that we were in the United Kingdom with measles as a result of the MMR vaccination until, very sadly, vaccine hesitant individuals and anti-vaxxers, as we call them in the UK, sowed so many doubts on the basis of absolutely no facts whatsoever. Ever that vaccination rates in the UK fell and we started to get outbreaks of measles and indeed of mumps and congenital rubella. So for now, there is no indication for a child under the age of 16 to have the vaccine. There are a few exceptions for younger people. If we are going to be giving them on the whole, we'll be giving them very late to teens, the younger, certainly not under the age of 18, and under the age of 16, not at all. But in the UK, not under the age of 18, even if they have an underlying condition. But individuals 16 and over who have high risk health conditions, which might put them at greater risk of complications, would have the opportunity to get the vaccine sooner, along with individuals from age 16 and upwards who are essential workers, particularly health and social care workers or working in care homes. Those are the ones that we are protecting in the UK. The health and social care workers, because they are so much more likely to contract COVID, the care home workers, because the people they look after are so much more vulnerable. So we know that children's immune systems are very different from adults. And we know that immune responses differ at different ages. Indeed, you can't lump all children together. A child of 3 may react very differently in terms of their immune system to a 16-year-old. And certainly, of course, as we've seen with MCIS, what we're seeing is in children that the majority of the children are older, not small infants. So as a result, the research that's being done needs to be repeated on children in different age cohorts. Now, Pfizer and Moderna have both started looking at younger children. As I mentioned, they have been down to children as young as 12. If those trials are successful, then they would need to go through all the same regulatory approval processes completely separately to the existing vaccines for adults. That process will take some time, and it may well be that we will not have vaccines in the near future, if at all, for children under the age of 12.
Thank you. We've now come to the end of this podcast series. Dr. Jarvis, thank you yet again for updating us on the latest scientific insights, which I'm sure our listeners will find incredibly useful. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you throughout this podcast series and learning about the latest scientific news regarding COVID-19 during breastfeeding, pregnancy, and infancy. Thanks again.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a real pleasure, and I do hope that it's been helpful to people listening.
Date with future episodes of Danone Nutrition Campus, the Feed podcast. Make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, or for more educational content from Danone Nutrition Campus, visit www.danonenutritioncampus.org.